Muzzle not the ox. How does the Old Testament apply today? 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 13 through 21, and 1 Corinthians chapters 8 through 10, was presented by Ron Julian on August 12, 2009, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the questions were inaudible. It is hoped that the presenter's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Okay, I'm going to say a few words about the passages that we looked at today. As it happens, in this particular case, I'm the person that chose the passages we looked at today. What I had in mind was Monday, in the passages that we looked at, we got an opportunity to think about the nature of the Mosaic Covenant and how you need to consider that when you read something there and you go to apply it and ask, what are we going to do with it? So what we're doing here is looking at a couple of examples where the New Testament authors are going back and doing that very process. They're going back and looking at the Old Testament and drawing this conclusion. One of them actually deals with an economic issue, one of them not specifically. Let me deal with the 1 Peter passage first. We'll just deal quickly with that. We may actually deal quickly with the whole thing. I don't know that I have a ton of stuff to say to you today, and you may be happy to hear that. So let's talk about 1 Peter first. Here's the nature of the problem as I saw it. In Leviticus 11, Moses is given the distinctions for clean and unclean animals. And we all know, we don't pay any attention to these distinctions when we eat these days, but Moses is given these very careful distinctions, and then God ends this instruction by urging Israel to keep them because he is holy. You should be holy because I am holy. We see Peter quoting that thing from Leviticus, saying that the Christians that he's writing to should avoid their former ignorant lusts, and he quotes this verse, "Be holy, for I am holy." Well, I think it's important for us to try to understand the nature of how Peter got to his conclusion from the passage that he started with. Because, now, I acknowledge that there are some other places in Leviticus where "Be holy, for I am holy" shows up, so it's not just strictly the issue of the clean and unclean animals. I kept it to that to keep things a little bit simple. But when it comes to this issue, for example, we know that Peter is among the first of those who came to know that God didn't really care about whether animals were clean or unclean. Peter has the vision where he's basically says to God, "I'm a good Jew. I don't eat unclean animals." And yet God ends up saying to him, "What I have declared clean, no longer consider unclean." And it becomes very much the understanding of the Jewish Christians in the New Testament, starting with Peter, that they are not to make an issue of the dietary regulations anymore. That there's nothing intrinsically disobedient or immoral about eating an animal that is unclean in terms of the old distinctions. So how does Peter move from the statement, "Be holy, for I am holy," which is spoken in support of something that he doesn't even think he needs to obey anymore, and yet he appeals to that and uses it to defend something that he doesn't seem to think is provisional at all? This is something that they just, by very virtue of being disciples of Christ and followers of God, that this is something they need to do. Well, here's how I would understand what he's doing. First of all, we want to try to get a feel for this word holy as to what exactly was happening there. It does not necessarily imply a moral issue. Something that was holy, Jack talked about this, I think, is something that is distinctive, set apart. It has that feel of don't step here because this is holy ground. It's that awe-inspiringly different. That's just not the regular stuff. That's different. And God is, above all things, holy because he is awe-inspiringly different from everything else, from the other gods who don't even exist, from us as morally flawed people, as limited and finite people, and so on. So I would summarize what I think Leviticus is getting at, and I think this is how Peter would look at it, is, look, God is saying, I have given you a whole set of commands that have to do with the idea of purity, of being holy or not holy, being clean or unclean, pure or impure. The idea that I'm telling you that there are certain animals that I'm saying are clean or unclean, we could debate what the rationale for that would be. How did God decide which were which, and why did he use that as criteria? That could be an interesting question. But ultimately, it comes down to God has said, I am asking you to eat in a ritually obedient way, and the idea is that everything you eat should be clean. Just as everything that he asks Israel to do, the issue is they are to keep themselves pure, ritually pure. There is to be no impurity at all. If they do anything that makes them unclean in any way, then they're ineligible to be a part of the assembly of the Lord, and they have to cleanse themselves so that they can be purified and come back in and be a part. So God has given them these rituals of purity to set them apart. The people look and say, why are you doing that stuff? And says, well, God has asked us to do this, and he's asked us to do this because he is holy. So when God gives his rationale, why should you eat only the clean animals, he's not saying that it is immoral to eat the animals that I've called unclean. He's saying instead, I have given you a ritual that involves the idea of purity, of cleanliness and uncleanliness, because I want you to understand in everything you do that I am holy and you are to be holy. I am holy in that I am awe-inspiringly different and distinct from the world around you. And included in that is the moral issue. God is morally pure. That's part of what makes him so different from us. So is it a moral issue whether you eat the clean or unclean animals? No. But the principle is the same. Why is it that God has called them to conduct themselves in this way? It's because he is distinct from the world. And it is to become clear, as the whole picture emerges, that for us, what is most important about God's holiness and distinctiveness from the world is that he is good, and he is just and merciful and all of that. So Peter can come along, and even though he knows perfectly well that he, at this point in his life as a Jew, has the freedom to eliminate all sorts of ritual requirements that he was once required to do, nonetheless, the principle is the same. The people of God are to emulate his holiness. And for us as Christians, then, the rituals have gone away, but the moral distinctiveness of God remains, and we are just as obligated as the Israelites were to be the people of God, distinct from the people around us, holy like God is holy. So I would say, if you were to ask Peter to defend why it is he quoted from a passage that has something to do with commands that we don't even obey anymore, I think it would be something like that that he's pointing to. And this actually, then, I think is an illustration of exactly the kind of thing that Jack was talking about on Monday. That, in essence, what we see in that be holy for I am holy is kind of an explanation that God is giving for a rationale for the ritual system that he has set up. That there is a ritual that is pointing to a greater reality, and that greater reality we are always obligated to understand and pursue. So that's why Peter is not telling his readers to eat a particular way, but he is telling them to be morally distinctive from the nations around them, because God is morally distinctive from the nations around them. Okay, so that's what I had in mind for the First Peter passage. The passage that was of more interest to me here was the First Corinthians one. There's quite a bit of interest to me anyway in this passage. This is the one, well, you know what it is, we were all just talking about it. At the heart of this passage is Paul's quotation of this command from Deuteronomy, don't muzzle the ox while he is threshing. It's interesting, at first it kind of seems like that command is just sort of set arbitrarily in a list of unrelated things. We talked a little bit in our group about how if you look in the larger context, there is kind of a theme of justice and dealing with people who are disadvantaged and so forth that lends a certain, perhaps, coherence to the section. But basically, we come up against this command, we're reading along, and it says, don't muzzle the ox while he's threshing. And we're faced with the question, so what are we to understand about that? I might easily read that and think, well, I don't have oxen, so this command no longer applies to me because this is for an agrarian society and that's not, it's not really relevant to me. Just like nobody goes up on my roof, so I don't feel the need to put a railing around it because nobody's going to fall off my roof because they shouldn't be on my roof. And if they go up on my roof and fall off, that's not my problem because they shouldn't be on my roof. So I might think that here's a command to somebody if he's got an ox, how he ought to treat him, and so I'll move on because it doesn't have anything to do with me. Paul quotes it, though, and in a way where the issue that he's talking about doesn't seem to have much to do with oxen. So how did he move from that to what he does? So let's look at that a little bit. I think we have to start with the command itself, and it seems reasonable. If Paul had said nothing, I think if we were to go through and to look at each law carefully and try to think about what is involved with this, as we look at the command to not to muzzle the ox, it makes a lot of sense that the picture is, okay, look, you have some grain that you need to have this threshing done to it, and you're going to profit, you're going to have food when the whole thing is done. The ox is going along, turning the wheel, and why would you muzzle the ox in the first place? Well, you muzzle it because if you don't, while he's walking along, the ox is going to eat the grain that's falling on the ground. And why do I have him threshing it? It's because I want the grain. I didn't set the ox out there threshing the grain so that I could feed the ox. I'm doing it so that I can feed myself and my family. So how can I maximize my profit out of this enterprise? Well, I make sure that I put a muzzle on the ox so I don't lose any grain while it's happening. So the command is, no, I don't want you to do that. I don't want you to muzzle the ox while he's threshing. I want you to let him eat while he's threshing your grain. So every time an Israelite goes to do that and is muttering a little under his breath, stupid ox is going to eat me out of all my grain and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So you have the opportunity to stop and ask yourself the question, why did God do this? Why did God set up this law? And if you think about it, well, isn't there something kind of ugly about having the ox working for me so that I can get grain out of it and I can eat? And yet, I'm not going to let the ox benefit at all from the work that he's doing. I'm so stingy that I'm perfectly willing for him to do all the work so that I have this threshed grain, but I'm not willing for him to have any. There's something just about me that's not right if I'm doing that. So it seems like the principle involved here is something that extends beyond just oxen. So to make it really, really clear, the first step might be, I can't get around this by getting another animal other than an ox to thresh my grain. So I'm not supposed to muzzle the ox, but if I could get, I don't know, a cow or something and have it do, I don't know if cows will do that, but then I can put a muzzle on the cow because the law only applies to oxen. Well, no, that doesn't really make sense. That doesn't seem to be what God is pointing at. And ultimately, if you think about it, it seems to really go beyond that altogether. I mean, just like the rest of God's laws seem to point to some issue of what it means to be faithful obedient to God, loving God, loving my neighbor, and all of that. There seems to be something in this that is pointing to the idea that there's something intrinsically wrong, letting somebody's work benefit me without my being willing for them to share in the benefit while they're doing it. I'm going to use them. The temptation, right, is to use people. I want to maximize my profit. If I can get you to do it in such a way that it doesn't cost me anything, I will, because I want to maximize my profit. The owner of the ox has all the power in the situation. He can put the muzzle on if he wants. And likewise, we are often in situations where, if we want to, we can use the labor of other people in such a way to gain ourselves without having it cost us anything. But the principle then that's being illustrated there is, that's ugly, that's stingy. There's something really unrighteous about being unwilling for the person who's working on your behalf, that you're not willing to share with them what it is that you've gained. So there is, then, we can say, wow, there's actually even a principle that applies to economics in what is being said here, is that I have a moral obligation to not think about the people that I'm dealing with strictly in terms of the economic gain that I can get out of them. There's this sense that there is something wrong with me if I'm not thinking about their welfare in the situation while I'm thinking about my own. And especially that idea that I'm going to profit by them and not let them profit at all from the work that they're doing. So there's a lot that we could say about that if we wanted to talk about that. And we also see here another example of this issue of how it is we approach something like in the Mosaic Law. Again, we seem to be seeing a principle there that goes beyond the actual literal description of what it is that's being commanded. That you can't just keep this command by keeping a muzzle off of your ox. That there's something bigger at stake. But I'd like to now try to put this into the context of 1 Corinthians to see what Paul is doing with it, because I think it's interesting. There's a kind of a layering effect that happens here. In our group, I sort of described this, if any of you have ever done work on a computer, if you have a program running and you have these instructions and it's doing various things, and at a certain spot you call a subroutine. So you leave the main program and you go off and you do this sub thing over here. And while you're in that subroutine, then that subroutine calls another subroutine and it goes over and it's doing this for a while. And then sooner or later that subroutine ends and you come back to the middle one and it finishes what it's doing and you finally come back to the main program. That's kind of what's happening in 1 Corinthians, is Paul has a main theme, but he takes off on something in support of that point, and he takes off on something there in support of that point, and then ultimately he works his way back to the original point that he had. So I think it's worth our while to look at that briefly as to what it is that he's doing. First of all, there's what Paul does with the thing about the ox. He says, "For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. God is not concerned about oxen, is he? Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sake it was written, because the plowman ought to plow in hope and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops." And you can see in the way Paul deals with it, is God concerned about oxen? He is implying, look, there is something more to deal with here than just if you happened to not put a muzzle on an ox, then you would have been okay. Paul is indicating that he sees something else going on there. And he describes that something else as the plowman ought to plow in hope and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. There is this principle involved that you're doing work, there is something appropriate about sharing in the benefit of the work. And notice what's important here is this is not so much a command to a person who's working, make sure you get somebody to pay you. This is really focused on the person who is receiving the benefit of the work. It's don't be perversely greedy such that you're concentrating only on what you can get out of the other person and not concerned with the opportunity that they have to benefit from what they're doing as well. Okay, So, but why does Paul do that? Why does he go off into the Old Testament and quote this thing about the ox? Well, that's a sub-point under a larger point that he wants to make. And his larger point that he wants to make is, I have the right to be financially supported by you guys. So he says, am I not free? Do we not have a right to eat and drink? Peter and the other apostles take their families along and are financially supported so they can do that. And am I some kind of schmuck or something? I don't get to be supported for the work that I'm doing? Think about the human examples. Doesn't a soldier get paid? A soldier doesn't pay his own way, right? The army pays for him and buys him his rifle and that stuff. Doesn't somebody who plants a vineyard get to eat from it? I mean, just think. Isn't that the way things work? And then doesn't the law teach the same thing? And then he points back to the thing about not muzzling the ox. And notice he's saying, look, that thing about not muzzling the ox shows that same principle. There is something appropriate and right about sharing in the benefit from the work that you're doing. So Paul is appealing back to this one verse dealing with an agricultural situation in the Old Testament to support the idea that he has the right to be financially supported by the Corinthians. But that is only a sub-point in his still larger point. Why does he insist that he has a right to be paid? Is he trying to convince the Corinthians that they ought to pay him? Is he about to sue them? I've been working all this time and I haven't got one dime, and if you don't pay up, I'm going to go to the judge and say, don't muzzle the ox while he's threshing. No. He's reminding them, some of the Corinthians don't really have much respect for Paul. So he is insisting to them, I do have a right to be financially supported. I know that some of you don't think that's true, but it is true. My work among you as an apostle is worthy of support. But, as he says, I didn't use that right. I did not take financial support from you. They might be inclined to say that the reason Paul didn't get paid is because he's not worth it, and they don't owe him anything. Paul is saying, well, actually, you do owe me something. It would be right and appropriate. It would, in fact, be wrong for you to think that I don't deserve to be paid for the work that I've done among you, to be supported by you. But I didn't use that right. I didn't take money from you. I will not take money from you. I don't want money from you. So his appealing to don't muzzle the ox is his way of defending the idea that he has a right that in fact he did not exercise. And I think, it seems to me, that what he has in mind is, we can see the turbulent relationship he had with the Corinthians, he didn't want them to think that he was in it for the money. For them to have any sort of way of dismissing him and saying, oh, we don't have to listen to him, his motives are suspect here. He's done this so that he could get money off of this. He's so concerned that they not be distracted by the issue of money that he doesn't want to take money from them so that they will be forced to confront the gospel and not be distracted by this issue of his motives in being supported. Okay, now, why did Paul say that? Is it that he just wanted to convince them, hey, I'm a pretty neat guy. I didn't take money from you guys. I think you should think highly of me because I'm a very moral person. No. He gives them this picture of himself not taking the money that he has the right to because he wants them to emulate that attitude in the issue that they're confronting. And now we're finally on the top. This is the issue that the part of the letter is about. That they're facing the question of whether or not to eat meat sacrificed to idols. And as I would interpret the situation, there's a group of people in Corinth who rightly understand that there is nothing wrong with eating meat sacrificed to idols. Paul would agree with them that there, in principle, is nothing wrong with eating meat sacrificed to idols. That's why he can say, look, when you go into the meat market, don't even ask. It doesn't matter. Don't be concerned with that because there's nothing about the meat that's going to hurt you or nothing about that meat that is unfaithful or anything like that. There are people in Corinth who know that, but they know it in an ugly and unloving way. And I think we've all seen this kind of thing. I feel like I have wrestled with not being this sort of person, and I've seen many people fall into this kind of trap, that if you know something, then you kind of think highly of yourself because you know it, and you think not very highly of people who don't know it the way you do. So there are these people who think that it is wrong to eat the meat sacrificed to idols. Probably many of them new Christians who are coming out of paganism there in Corinth. And they think, oh no, I don't want to have anything to do with idolatry or any of that kind of stuff. And so those who are in the know, they say, oh no, there's nothing wrong with that. They're putting pressure on these ones who have scruples about eating it to eat. It's not just the situation that the people who don't eat happen to catch the person who does eat eating it sometime or something like that. I think it's a concerted effort to get the other folks to knuckle under, to acknowledge we're the cool ones. We're the ones who really know how this works. You need to stop being naive and join us in our sophistication. But the problem is that there is this potential for actually encouraging someone, leading someone into violating their conscience, that they're going to join you in it, not because they have become convinced that it's right, but because they like your cool, I want to be part of the cool crowd too, and so they join you even though they have a real problem with it and they think they're probably doing something wrong. Something like that is the kind of issue. So what Paul wants to say to the ones who know that they have the right to eat is the fact that you have the right to eat it doesn't determine whether you should eat it or not. Because there's more than just the question of whether you have the right to do it. There is the question of love. There is the question of how your behavior is going to affect the people around you. And in fact, what is more important than encouraging a young believer that you are a part of a group of Christians with? What is more important than encouraging them to follow their conscience in following God? What could be worse than encouraging them to disobey God, even though in fact you're in the right and you know that there's really not an issue with eating the meat sacrificed to idols? So, then these are the layers as we go back in. Paul's ultimate concern, when you think about whether you're going to eat the meat sacrificed to idols, you need to think about the impact on someone else. Just because you have the right doesn't mean you should do it. Now we come in a layer. Let me talk about myself. I have the right to be financially supported by you guys, but I didn't take it because I don't want to cause you to stumble. I don't want to get in the way of your dealing with the gospel. We'll take that in a layer. Do I have a right to support? Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do have a right to financial support by you. And one of the things that I would point to is don't muzzle the ox while he's threshing. Because that's the principle there that says, if I'm working on your behalf, I'm here laboring for the salvation of your souls, it would be ugly and ungenerous of you not to help me and to benefit from my labor so that I might be able to eat and keep body and soul together while I'm busy laboring for your benefit. So, I have the right, just look at the ox, but I didn't use it, and ultimately that's what I want you to do as well. Okay, so what are the points that I would like to see emerge from this? I'll just say this quickly and then we can go to the question part. Oh, I skipped one. There was the 1 Timothy passage as well. So that one's more simple. It's just using that language that teaching elders are worthy of double wages, basically, I think what Paul's saying is. If they are overseeing the church and also spending their time teaching and edifying the body in that way, you ought to be supporting them in their doing that. And he quotes two things, the thing about not muzzling the ox, again, the principle of the one who is working for your benefit, you shouldn't be stingy and not let them benefit as well. And then the other language, the worker is worthy of his hire, which is interesting. The only place that we know of where that shows up is in Jesus' teaching. Jesus is the one who uses the language, the worker is worthy of his hire, which is what he says to the disciples when he sends them out into the villages to preach and they're to stay there and have somebody stay in somebody's house and so forth. And part of his explanation of why it's okay for them to be staying at somebody's house and have them feed them and take care of them and everything, he says the worker is worthy of his hire. Okay, so that one's a simpler one than the 1 Corinthians passage. Okay, so what I think is relevant to us as we try to approach the Bible to understand economic issues, First of all, the New Testament authors see the process here as one of understanding the deeper purpose of God behind the specifics of the laws of the covenant. It doesn't work to just say, look, it says in the covenant, do this, so this is what we should do. Because in each case, you have to decide, what is it there for? Is it a ritual? Is it a moral principle? When it says, love your neighbor as yourself, that is what we're being commanded to do. That's not a ritual that points to something else. That is the command itself. That is the very moral principle that we are to embrace. When it says, don't mix two kinds of fabrics, now we have to go farther. Does God care whether I mix fabrics? No. So what does he care about? We have to do that. We always have to do that when we approach the Old Testament or the Bible, really. And we have to try to see what is it that in fact was intended to be the point. And if we don't do that, which at times the Pharisees are a great example of those who did not do that, they saw keeping the rules as being paramount, and they didn't ask nearly enough the question, but what was that rule actually pointing to? And that's what Jesus accuses them of many times. So we see in both in Peter and in Paul here examples of treating the Old Testament in that way. We also see that there is a principle here that does inform our view of the economic relationships between people, that at least for me, whenever I am in the position of benefiting from someone else's work, I need to want to be the kind of person who is willing to not see it strictly in terms of how much can I get out of the other person, but see it in terms of they are benefiting me, it is right and appropriate that I generously let them benefit from it at the same time. And that is a principle that applies to a lot of things. And then in 1 Corinthians, we see that even beyond that, though, the issue of rights, whether economic or not, ultimately have to be put under the issue of what is loving. I may have a right to something, but the interest of being loving to other people overrides that. It is more important that I am working for your benefit than that I have a right not to. So more important than rights is love. Okay, so we're going to have questions now. I actually stopped a little early. That's good. We can stop the questions a little early if we want to. But before anybody asks a question, I get the first question. Because Charlie's going to come up here. And that's right. Yeah, hey, that's good. I'm just trying to show you how the principle works out here. Okay, so here, I know this may mess things up because I would like Charlie to comment on this, and I would like comments from whoever out here can be helpful in sorting this out. But our group, we got to talking about trying to understand with Keynes what exactly the nature of the general theory. We saw him talking about the government controlling consumption by a determining interest rate and through taxation. But the question that we kept going back and forth on and had a hard time resolving is, was he advocating a particular use of taxation? To wit, was he saying the government ought to be taxing, or the government should raise taxes, the government should lower taxes, or the government should just raise or lower them in accordance with what might work? So here's where I got. And so this is my question. And I think I've come to a place where I understand this, but I would like comments from anybody who thinks they understand how this stuff is working. I would argue that in the section that we were looking at, that there are a number of statements there that indicate that Keynes believes in taxing the very rich. That is, just in general, as a principle, taxing the very rich. He talked about lowering the stakes so that you can take risks and make money, but nobody can make as much money as you might want. You got to bring that down. And I would point to a number of things in there that seemed to me that he was suggesting that. At the same time, I'm aware, we came out and I asked about half a dozen people how they would answer that question. And I'm aware that Keynes, in the part of the book that we didn't look at, would say in general that government uses taxation depending on what the situation is. As David put it, if the economy is getting really hot, then you tax a lot, kind of bring things down. If you're getting a slump and things are really cooling off, then you lower taxes so that people have more money to put into the economy. Okay, so I have come away then with the picture that both of those things are true. That is, that in general, he would say for everybody, the general tax rate, that the government keeps things on an even keel by taxing everybody high at one end or taxing low at another end to kind of keep things in that middle spot. But there's this other principle that those who have a lot of money, the old idea that savings were somehow ultimately going to do the job is not right, and that there's this one part where he talks about taxing very wealthy through taxes and also through inheritance tax. So my picture is that he would say, in general, for everybody's taxes, you either lower or raise taxes depending on what you're trying to accomplish, but in fact, in pursuit of a certain amount of equity and also for the benefit of the economy, you take money from the very rich, who are always going to have a lot, no matter what the situation is, and pump it into the economy by taxing them. So I've had some people say no. Some people, I saw David nodding his head going yes. So I'm interested in, my question is, what is the general theory? And is what I just said right or not? So I'd like to hear what Charlie says about that, and anybody who has a comment on that, I'd like to hear.
Actually, just a point of clarification. When you say what the general theory is, do you mean just with regard to those two issues, or the general theory?
Well, yeah. I'm interested in the bigger question, too, but I'm saying on that. When the thing starts out, he talks about setting interest rates and taxation as the things that the government can use, and I guess I'm trying to get a picture of what did he want the government to do with taxation?
I agree with what you said and what I understood that David articulated. I think he's just pretty pragmatic what's going to work here. His argument is these are actually tools that we can use to accomplish goals with. These are not tools specifically that a classical economist is going to be very desirous of using to solve these kind of problems. So that's part of his move. That's part of his critique, is he's saying the mechanisms you propose, which in large part is just back off here, well, in time that may do something, but we actually can do something in the shorter run to solve that problem, like use these tools, however it's appropriate.
Okay, and both of those things that I mentioned would be tools that he would advocate using.
Yeah, and the other part of this is one part that I take away from Keynes that for me is interesting, and maybe this is where I have blinders, and I always try to pick this up. But at least what the classical economists are trying to do at this point in time is they want a mechanistic model of how this works. They want to divide it down, make this a mechanical model, and say, if we do this, here's how it's going to work. So we understand the mechanisms of how this works. Keynes says, well, we don't have the slightest idea how this whole thing works. Nobody knows. But there are these tools we can use, and we've seen that they generally work. But I'm not saying this is mechanically how any one thing affects anything else, because you never can isolate one or two things from this bigger, complex thing that's going on. So at least as I read Keynes, he always has that critique of the classical economists of his time in mind. So when they approach a problem, they want to say, well, given this set of scenarios, we do X, and then deterministically, sort of mechanically, this is what's going to be the effect. Keynes is saying, well, one, that assumes you know a lot. You really understand how this works. One, I don't think anybody does. But two, we generally see a suite of tools here we can use, and under different sets of circumstances, we can see that this or this in combination, given this sort of a context, usually. So he's much fuzzier, he's less deterministic about how he sees it, but he is looking at sort of general trends, like the one I talked about, like money supply or taxes and interest. He says, well, we have seen patterns, and under sets of circumstances similar to this, that's sort of going to work. But let's not mechanically say it's always going to work in these sets of circumstances. So that's always a critique he has.
So one of the things, I guess, that surprised me, I am the person on the staff that knows the least about economics, so I'm just totally learning in this whole thing. But all of the people that I've ever encountered that have called themselves Keynesian, or people talk about a Keynesian approach to economics, I've never encountered a Keynesian, and this is surely probably just my limited experience, but I've never encountered a Keynesian who advocated lowering taxes. It always seemed to be that the idea would be that the government should have some money so that it can do stuff. I've never heard that, the Keynesian idea that we're going to...
I mean, I don't claim to be an expert on what he said, and to be honest, I have not read his whole book in the last probably 15 years, so he may say something about that specifically, but I don't recall it. It seems to me that although I don't think there's anything in principle that would deny him from saying that, in a certain set of circumstances, that may be an appropriate tool to use. Well, that in the situation where you find yourself, that an appropriate use of a tool might be to lower taxes. Yeah.
David, you said you thought that he does advocate lowering taxes in the right situation.
I don't remember, but that would make sense.
Yeah. Well, that's...
As I understand it, like Charlie said, he's really saying, here's a toolbox. The classical economists don't acknowledge.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this is a toolbox that is necessary because the classical mechanics don't always work. There mm-hmm. are times when the economy will get stuck in a down cycle, and in our lifetimes it won't pull out. And so what has to happen, the only thing that makes sense, and the biggest concern is, in a downturn you need people to come along and be willing to invest, to increase production. But in a downturn, when things are bad, who's going to be inclined to invest in businesses that might go bankrupt? Mm-hmm. Nobody. Mm-hmm. So we've got to get something to get us around the corner, so then people start investing and interest rates can start climbing.
That's where those two things seem to be in conflict. Lower taxes so that people have more money to spend. But I thought the idea was the government is going to provide demand by buying stuff. And doesn't the government have to have lots of tax money so that it can do that?
What he's saying is there has to be a burst of investment.
Keynes' perspective is that it doesn't matter how that comes. We just have to have a burst of investment. We have to have dollars going out there that signal to the producers, it's time for me to do more. Because as long as things are still going down, no one's going to invest. So we aren't going to have an increase in productivity and production, and we need to get around that corner. And he's saying, the only way I can see that happening is for the government to do it. They're the only investor that can be motivated to do it and has the resources to do it. And they can do that in a number of ways. They could lower taxes and give people that have more money, therefore, to spend. But in a depression, people don't make a lot of money, so lowering taxes isn't going to do much. So what's more likely is the government's going to have to spend more. Where's it going to get it? It either prints it or it borrows it. Mm-hmm. But it's got to get money from somewhere that it's going to inject into the economy.
Right. And so what I was just going to add is another piece of this is Keynes would say that the government could just deficit spend here. I mean, we don't really have to balance the budget.
Absolutely.
So we could, in fact, lower taxes and increase government spending
Absolutely.
As a possibility here just because...
Or print more money, or we can borrow.
Mm-hmm. For whatever it's worth, Galbraith, the guy on the mm-hmm. paper Friday, who's the biggest Keynes in the U.S. after Keynes, did on a couple of occasions say we should cut taxes. Mm-hmm. The impression he did grudgingly. He was much more in favor of raising taxes. But sometimes he was like, yeah, let's cut the taxes.
People want to think about that question for a minute. Something strange occurred to me while I was reading this Leviticus and Timothy passage. Is the possibility that Moses was quoting a figure of speech when he says, don't muzzle the ox when he's threshing, that they may have understood that not to mean don't literally muzzle the literal ox when he's threshing, that he was just to turn a phrase to mean don't have people work for free. But oddly enough, in that culture, that ancient Hebrew culture, and in the modern Greek Romanized culture that Paul is re-quoting it in, they had slaves. And it seems like a very strange principle to lay down in law if you're also going to keep slaves. And Paul would allow slavery to continue. Can you address that? Because I'm...
Ultimately, no, that's a really big question. It is, my understanding that slaves in the Roman Empire were paid. So it's like, it's kind of indentured servitude. I can't just decide to quit today. But in fact, they would get paid and they would save up so that when they got themselves out of slavery, which they often did, then they would have a nest egg to start a business or something like that. So now, obviously, the Roman Empire was not concerned with fulfilling Old Testament law. And I don't think that Paul's, the fact that he didn't fight it doesn't necessarily mean that he thought that it was fundamentally righteous institution. That's where it gets tricky. What do you do with, if I am a slave and there is something, well, someone like Peter, you know, like I've been talking about in 1 Peter, he's talking to people who are slaves who are being mistreated. There's not even any question that it's just. Even if slavery itself were just, it's not just what's happening to them. And yet, the bigger issue for him is, how am I going to respond to that? What am I going to do with that? So the New Testament authors are always more concerned with that. What personal choice am I going to make in response to this institution? And as to being a figure of speech, that's one of the possibilities. We talked about that in our group. When you look at the thing, either it is strictly a command having to do with oxen, meant to be literally obeyed. It's metaphorical in that nobody ever really intended, the way I put it is, somebody could go by and they see somebody over there and his ox doesn't have a muzzle on and he's going along and they say, "You idiot, why don't you have a muzzle on your ox? He's going to eat up all your grain." And he says, "Well, the command, you know, in the law it says this." And they all laugh and say, "You jerk, that's a metaphor. You know, that wasn't, they don't care about ox." That's a, so that's another possibility. And then the third one is that it was intended as a command. It wasn't a metaphor in the sense that when they looked at that, they said, "Oh, I see what I'm supposed to do. If I have an ox, I shouldn't muzzle it when it's threshing. But at the same time, if I'm a faithful follower of the law who's trying to understand what God is doing, I recognize that he has something bigger in mind." And I kind of lean towards the third one. But yeah, I suppose it's possible that it could be a metaphor.
When Keynes talks about savings, is he talking about the same kind of savings that we naturally think of? What does he picture when he's talking about savings?
Well, Keynes's view of savings, what we naturally seem to go to first is we think of this as like personal savings. You have to remember, first and foremost, Keynes is not interested in economics at this level. So what he's interested in is savings essentially by the economic unit. So it's more abstract. So it could be held by individuals, but it's savings in all categories, so it's an abstract term in the macroeconomy. And past that, I don't think I could give you a more technical definition. Somebody else could help with that. But, well, it's monies that, and there's a certain time frame or a certain availability on it, short-term or long-term, but it's financial resources that essentially can be invested.
I'll just point out that there are two kinds of savings. One would be where I take my money and put it under my mattress. The other kind of savings is where I take my money and I put it into a financial institution which turns around and loans it out to somebody at interest. Keynes is scared to death of the mattress kind of savings. That's why the comments about taxing the wealthy when there's a downturn, you don't want people just sitting on their money. That is money that's wasted as far as he's concerned. That's got to get out there and do something. So he wants that out from under their mattresses, and he wants that into the economy. The savings that goes into a financial institution and is invested, that's fantastic, because that's a stimulus to production.
Yeah, perfect. Going off of that, he says the best thing to do is to spend when there's a problem and the economy's down. I was wondering, does he see that as something the government has to enforce, or is he just placing that out there for the people? Hey, look, we got to spend. We got to get the money back into circulation, stimulate economy. Seems less socialist.
In his view, his terminology is aggregate demand, and by that he means both demand by individuals and by the government. One of the things that's happened here that Keynes is picking up on is back in Adam Smith's day, the government wasn't as big a contributor to the economy as it has become. And so one of the things that happens, well, in Adam Smith's time, it was a much more minor component, so it was easier not to have it a big major factor. But one of the changes that's happened here is, look at what portion now of the total economy is government. It's become very large. So one of Keynes's points here is, you can't ignore it. So it's government demand as well as individual demand. And so, as I say, Keynes has sort of turned the analysis sort of around. When the hard times come, the classical people want to focus a lot of them on the supply side. But Keynes says you can supply all you want, but if there isn't any demand for those products, nothing's going to move. And so his analysis is, you have to create the demand, and it's both government and individual. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, kind of. That's good enough.
Well, is there more?
No, that's okay.
So what would Keynes say about a penny saved is a penny earned? And then also, second question, why is increasing demand any less problematic than increasing supply?
Okay, on the first one, is a penny saved a penny earned? I think there's two answers. Yeah. Well, I think Keynes would say it's more complicated. If the penny saved is, well, remember now, Keynes' answer to this is going to be macro. It's not going to be for an individual. So that's one of the things that...
So is it Keynesian disallowing any analogy with personal finance? The wisdom and common sense of personal finance does not apply at the macroeconomic level. Is that...
You mean, on a personal level, it would be wise for me, it would be better for me to stick the money under the mattress than spend it on something I don't need and want or something like that? So personally,
what would be prudent in my managing my personal finances? There are a lot of people arguing what is prudent for me in my personal finances is to not go into big debt. Mm-hmm. Keynes is saying that's not prudent for the nation, I would assume. And is that because they just disallow any analogy between the wisdom of personal finances and the wisdom of national finances, macroeconomics?
Well, I'm not sure, but my first inclination is that a Keynesian may see a situation where what individuals do might not be necessarily in their best interest, but it might be the case that it would be in the macro scenario. But you run a risk, of course, of at some point the accumulated little individual things become the macro. But at least as the way I read it, their focus has become really just at this macro level, and there's less. The interest in individuals is an abstraction. So I don't know if that's answering your question. I don't know specifically. I don't recall reading any parts of Keynes. That would be my best guess from what I've seen of you.
David, building on that, so you're saying, is my question about this recent economic crisis, because a lot of it has to do with the regulation that has allowed people to go into debt that they couldn't afford. Is that still good for an economy? I mean, I wonder if Keynes was here today, if he wouldn't say that we need people to not be in the kind of debt and the quantity of debt that they're in.
On a point like that, I don't think Keynes would deviate from classical economics, that he would say the same thing that a classical economist would say, that people ought not get into debt greater than they can manage. But a Keynesian economist, when we come to the macro scale, that's a different issue. They see that as a whole different beast, and they don't see that as a problem. Now, I took economics before we had national debts reaching the scale that they're reaching now, and I think even a Keynesian economist would recognize at some point your debt gets so great that the nation runs the risk of going bankrupt. If people won't buy bonds because they think they're insecure, then your nation is in deep, deep trouble. Deep, deep trouble. And I can't imagine that a Keynesian economist wouldn't acknowledge at some point the scale of debt gets so large that you run that risk.
But would you look at it also and say, look, the regulation has created, by making it so big, by keeping the regulation of interest rates so low, it has created this problem where people, what the increase in money supply was actually not because people were just spending their money, but people were going into debt to buy things. Wouldn't he, I know it's on a personal level, but wouldn't he take, I mean...
I think Keynes would have been appalled at that, just like Greenspan was appalled at it.
Yeah.
I think that one other thing to dial in on the whole way that Keynes might suggest that the government is organized or controlled is that when things are in recession, which is what we've been focusing on in the Depression, then you want to try and deficit spend, perhaps lower taxes, do anything that you can to get businesses to invest to improve the economy and to get people buying things and the government buying things to improve the economy. On the flip side, I'm not sure, but I don't think that he would suggest that that particular kind of behavior should continue once you've reached what he would call full employment. Once you've got things going, then you really don't want to be participating in that kind of behavior. Because once you've got things going and everything is going hunky-dory, if you continue that behavior, deficit spending and lowering interest rates and stuff like that, then you're going to kill your economy with inflation. And I think that he would see that as a real downside of things. So I suspect he would say that when things are going well, then you maybe want to raise taxes a little bit and reduce the amount of debt that the government has or that the country has. So the boom time and the downtime, you have different policies. So perhaps in the long run, I don't think that he would suggest that, well, maybe, I don't know, but perhaps in the long run, you'd sort of mitigate that growing debt by the boom times.
Yeah, I agree with that. And one of the things I was trying to highlight in why I gave the little comment about a little bit of concern in the movie of how they portrayed Keynes and Hayek was essentially that point, is what Keynes is really saying is when you get to a point where there's a problem, either you're on the bottom end or when you get very hot, so you're running the risk on the other side. When you basically push the boundaries, that's when you need to act. But other than that, he's saying free market economy and those mechanisms, they work okay. So his major concern was just when it started to get out of control or was getting to a point where it couldn't right itself in a short period of time. Now, what's changed in the intervening time, in large part, is a lot of his followers don't agree with him that it should be limited to just those times. It's become much more the tendency to micromanage it all the time. And it seems to me, as I read Keynes anyway, his primary concern is only when it gets to the point of not being able to right itself, that it'll reach a point near its boundaries it can't, that the normal classical free market mechanisms can't pull it back in a reasonable period of time. And that's his concern. And so that's why I said I think it was a little bit unfair to paint him as he was painted in the video. Well, that's tricky. It seems to me that's tricky because, one, it's not a real clear, concise theory. It's pretty fuzzy. But I mean, in fairness to him and his comments throughout the book about saying that he isn't against the free market working, I'm inclined to be sympathetic enough to him to say that his interest really is at the time that it gets out of whack, and that really is when this mechanism happens. But there also is a tendency, sort of a natural consequence, and you can see this just in his own thought. I mean, he ran the war economy. Why do you run a war economy? And the answer is, because you really do think you can run it better than it could by itself. The goals are a little different and whatever, but once you've entered that, once you get into war and you just say, oh, it's better, we can do a better job of running the economy. Well, it seems to me also that for somebody like Keynes, who was running the economy of England during the war economy, that belief that he can run it is going to carry over, even though it seems to me from what he's written, at least he's more hands-off. Does that make sense? But I think there is a sense in which he ultimately, I think, although it's not articulated, since he did run that economy, I think he thinks he could do a better job, especially when it's out of whack, out of the center.
This is shifting gears a little bit, back to 1 Corinthians 10. I was just not clear on a couple of things where it talks about a list of what Moses did with the people of Israel, eating spiritual food and spiritual drink, and it basically says in verse 4, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. That seemed like a little bit of a leap, I guess, so I'd like to understand that leap a little bit better. And then also what follows that, it says, nevertheless, with most of them God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. That was a little confusing. And then it talks about, don't be like the idolaters. As it was written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. And I didn't really understand that either. So that whole section was kind of confusing for me, actually.
Yeah. I'm not going to be able to answer every part of your question. I don't remember what I decided, if I ever did, exactly how to understand the rock was Christ part. But in general, let me describe what I think is happening there, and then maybe you can get more specific, see where we can go. The problem, as Paul poses it in chapter 8, has to do with people who know that they have the right to eat meat sacrificed to idols, and he's talking about the impact that they have on those who don't understand that. But it seems to me that there's another phenomenon that kind of happens with that I know it's all right kind of thing, which is that sort of actual inner sort of perverse delight at dabbling in things that I know I'm not supposed to be dabbling in. So I think when he gets to chapter 10, what he wants to do is give the model of Israel in the wilderness as an example. Look, they were all, just like you are a believer and you go to the meal that I set up there once a week where you're having the wine and the bread and you're part of this community of Christians. Well, that's like the Israelites who had this community of, they all shared in this experience in the wilderness. And yet, in fact, they were not believers, basically, is what he's saying. God was not pleased with them. The fact that they were all in it together in this thing that was happening that God was doing there doesn't mean that individually they were actually, in fact, devoted to God. And what he wants to warn them in chapter 10 is that you need to be very careful that you are watching yourself, that your insistence on pushing this right to eat the meat sacrificed to idols and trying to drag other people into it isn't in fact related to a certain kind of perverse delight in idolatry itself. Because if that's the case, the fact that you're a part of a Christian community isn't going to ultimately rescue you. And isn't that, I should have brought my Bible up here, but isn't that where Paul goes on to talk about buffeting his body and that stuff, isn't that in that? Paul is concerned to, oh, thanks, maybe that's a good idea. Yes. Okay, so that was before that. Well, but it's part of the same context here. Paul introduces this idea in 9 with the idea that he doesn't want to be disqualified. He's recognized, look, okay, so just because I'm an apostle and I teach this stuff and everything, my decision to give up my rights in love for others, or my decision to live like a Jew when I'm among Jews, or Gentiles when I'm among Gentiles, that is coming out of my own personal desire to be a believer myself and live in accordance with the truths of the gospel, lest I be disqualified. Just the fact that I'm an apostle even doesn't mean that I'm going to be saved. It is by being personally embracing these truths that I'm going to be saved. So his warning to them is, don't toy with this idolatry stuff. What you are called to do is to turn away from idolatry and to follow God. And if you start dabbling with it, you're going to end up just like the Israelites. The thing about the people, well, this one doesn't have it that way, but they ate and drank and the play and all that stuff, that is understood to be just kind of a coy way of describing Israel giving itself over to debauchery connected with sort of idolatrous debauchery is kind of the thing that's going on. And that's the great story of Israel in the wilderness. God rescues them out of Egypt. They go along. They get there. They refuse to go into the land. And at that point, God says to them, I think he says 10 times, you put me to the test while we were going along, because even though I did all this stuff, you really don't trust me. You really don't. So I think what Paul is doing there is using these examples from Israel's past to say, just because you're a part of the experience of what God is doing with a community doesn't mean that you're going to be okay unless you personally have submitted to God and so forth. Is there anything left over in your question I should deal with then?
Well, just to add a little twist, because I think part of what I'm struggling with in the context of that and the larger passage is there are specific actions where a person can really believe that they're doing it in love and they can believe that God allows it, but it appears by the law to be wrong, even if they're not considered under the law, and it gets mm-hmm. tricky. Mm-hmm. And I especially have heard homosexuality being explained in that way, where it seems to be about love. It seems to be that the passages that describe it in the Bible could be interpreted a different way, and that therefore, if it's a monogamous homosexual relationship, it's okay. And so I guess in the meat of that last bit, I'm trying to understand, how would an issue like that be dealt with?
Okay, well, I would say that Paul's concern is not with a particular violation or not violation. That is, the people that he's talking to, one of them could be eating meat sacrificed to idols in a kind of proud way, an arrogant way that is unloving, but they could be a genuine believer who's just immature and hasn't really understood, come to terms with what they need to, because most believers go through stuff like that as they're going along. But he's also concerned that somebody could be, the guy right next to him could be doing that same thing, but it's motivated from something deeper, which is an essential sort of rebellion against God. So I think that's the way Paul looks at all of those kinds of issues. It's not the particular behavior that I would look at and say, just because either I know that it's wrong or I know that they think it's wrong, but I think it's okay. That's not just the issue. It really comes down to that question of the heart. So there are a number of questions that are related to homosexuality. Is it or is it not true that the Bible would condemn homosexuality as being against the will of God? And then if it is against the will of God, what does it mean then if a particular person is engaged in that? What does it mean if a person calls themselves a believer and they're engaged in that? And I would say that question has all of the complexity of any other of those kinds of questions. That if it is true that homosexuality is against the will of God, which I think it is, the basis for that is one of the moral precepts that we face is to stay away from perversity. And what I mean by that is I try to understand the way God has made the world to work. And if God has made the world to work this way, but I want it to work another way, I am to submit to the will of God for his creation and say, but this is the way he wants it to go. Now, I can be mistaken about that and impose rules that aren't rules at all. But the principle would be that it's not just don't hurt another person. That's not the only moral issue. The part of loving God is recognizing, submitting to his will, what he wants for things. So that's the kind of rationale that Jesus uses when he talks about divorce. Look, can't we look back at the institution of marriage to see what God made it to be? So even if both people are perfectly happy, there's something perverse about divorce because it's going against what God made marriage to be. But divorce is one of those issues. Just because we can all pretty much agree that Jesus has something down, he doesn't like something about divorce, that doesn't mean that divorce is automatically, oh, you're bad people, you couldn't be a Christian or anything like that. So those issues kind of need to be addressed separately, I think. What is the Bible teaching about that, and what is the particular state of the individual in relationship to what the Bible teaches at any given time? What you're looking for is the trajectory. What concerns me most about things that I hear, like on the issue of homosexuality, is, I just saw this the other day, somebody saying, I wouldn't follow a God who said that there was something wrong with the way I am. Okay, that's a really scary sort of thing to say, because there certainly are some things wrong with me, and if I haven't quite figured out yet all of the things that those are, to sort of take the stand to say, no, I've set the parameters for what is acceptable for God to tell me. That's the part that gets scary. So that's the part I think that we need to concern ourselves mostly with. That's how I would see it. Okay, we're sort of running late, but we'll go one more.
I'd also say that, just a quick thing, if you have to attempt to justify a certain behavior, I'd say there is something wrong with it if you have to find out how it is right. If you have to justify yourself, are you not?
Do you mean that amounts to kind of trying to rationalize something that is obviously wrong, that I'm trying to find some way of rationalizing?
Yeah. For all the classic things that are not explicated against in the New Testament under the New Covenant, things that people try to rationalize, if it goes against what you presume to be the nature of God, I mean, what is in your heart, if it's something that is questionable, does not the very fact that you're trying to rationalize or justify it demonstrate that it's wrong? That you have to find a reason for it to be right?
That's a tricky one. If you're trying to rationalize it, I think, yeah, that indicates that something's wrong. If you're trying to understand it, I think if you're in a spot where you genuinely don't know how to think about where you are, it seems to me that that can be an appropriate thing. I mean, I can't actually explain. I have some feelings like I might be wrong, but on the other hand, I'm not sure. So I don't think we're called upon to take the stance that unless I can prove that what I'm about to do is right, that it must therefore be wrong. I think that's not the way it would work. But yeah, we definitely have got to be aware of how ready we are to rationalize and try to justify ourselves. I mean, that's all of us do that, and that's important to know.
Prudence would suggest when in doubt, don't.
Yeah, that's a tricky one.
I'm not saying adopt it as a principle, just...
Okay. Well, see, this is a big topic. Let me just say, I would say that in a certain way, you could say the Pharisees had the principle, when in doubt, don't, and Jesus criticized them for it. So there's a way that that can go bad. There's a good side to that, but there's a way that that can go bad too. So that's a tricky one, I think. Okay, so we're done.